Well, hello. Today I'll be sharing some TV gems you may not have discovered, give you my full review of The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, and offer yet another reason to hate the TSA, as if we needed any more. I'm Justin Eisenstadt, and you just got to the good part. Strap in and sit tight, because we are boldly going nowhere. Hello, hello, hello. I am Justin Eisenstadt, and this is, of course, Boldly Going Nowhere. Today is Sunday, January 17th, 2010, and I'm once again on my own. In fact, I am all alone at the moment in my apartment, because all my roommates are sadly not here. And Colin, unfortunately, cannot make it once again, but it's okay. We're going to soldier on, and he will be back with us for our next episode. I hope you all enjoyed the different intro there. I'm trying to mix it up a little bit. You know, variety is, of course, the spice of life. And I figure if I'm going to be doing an episode by myself today, wouldn't really make sense to have Colin there at the beginning. You know, that would just be deceitful of me. You know, get you all geared up to listen to me and Colin talk, and then... Sorry, Colin and I talk for you grammar Nazis out there. And then, of course, find out that it's just me. Disappointing as that may be, it is, you know, just something you're going to have to deal with. It's today's reality, and, you know, I think it'll work out. But, I actually thought the intro worked a little better. I like the first intro we recorded, but I don't want it to get old, and maybe having this little, you know, kind of bulletin-style announcement right there in the intro... You know, telling you what's in store will maybe work out a little better, and, you know, no nasty surprises for you. To be honest, I'm still recovering today, folks. I'm still recovering from my excursion to the International House of Pancakes. Today, my roomies and I went for all-you-can-eat pancakes at IHOP. And this is no joke, folks. This is no laughing matter.
All-you-can-eat pancakes are back at IHOP, starting at $4.99. Get pancake after fluffy buttermilk pancake until you say when. The value you've always known us for is now even better. IHOP. Come hungry, leave happy. And try one of our four new flavored coffees.
Now, that was, of course, the promo, the little commercial on IHOP's website, actually, for their all-you-can-eat pancake special. And that sound effect you heard at the beginning there, that little sound effect that kind of sounded like the sound effect from the Bionic Man, from the $6 million man, that was actually, and I guess this will require a little bit of explanation, which is why it's meant to be seen rather than heard, or seen in addition to being heard. That was a plate of pancakes, a plate of half-eaten pancakes forming back together, The pancakes melding and merging and becoming fresh, whole new pancakes right on the plate to the wonderment and amazement of the man who is sitting there enjoying these pancakes. And folks, this isn't just some little shtick. This isn't just some gimmick that's being put on for your benefit. You, the viewer, or you, this case, you, the listener. No, that is actually how IHOP does business. We're talking some real heavy-duty wizardry type stuff here. I mean, I know, it was pretty amazing. It was pretty amazing when I saw it firsthand, but let me tell you, after three or four plates of fluffy, delicious buttermilk pancakes, the sight does not become any less spectacular. I gotta tell you, and the other sound at the end, which was just pouring coffee, that was the coffee refilling itself. Again, that's why this was meant to be seen. Because it has to be seen. It has to be seen to believed. Alright? I mean, the commercial's one thing, but actually having a plate of pancakes reform itself? Now, that's, like I said, no laughing matter. So, we ate more than our fair share of pancakes. You know, I felt a little bad. Mainly physically, because no human being should eat that many pancakes in one sitting. But also, you know, emotionally, morally, I felt a little wrong, which is why I'd be remiss if I did not, you know, tell you all to donate a crapload of money to whatever Haiti relief fund you think is most appropriate. I know maybe at this point some of you might be, well, frankly, tired of hearing that. I don't know. This isn't one of those things you can really get tired of hearing about. This isn't, you know, celebrity gossip. This is, you know, a huge natural disaster with rather far-reaching consequences for everyone. So I think it's the duty of any person who's, you know, sending any sort of mass media message. I mean, maybe it's a little presumptuous of me to call what I'm doing here mass media, but I think anyone who's you know, in even in the rather modest position that I'm in, has the duty to, you know, to reinforce that it's important. I mean, it's important to help out people, and I'll give you three opportunities right here. All can be done through text messaging. I know how you kids love the text messaging. If you text the word Haiti, H-A-I-T-I, if you don't know how to spell the island, although at this point I think you've probably been seeing the word all over the place, all over the internet, all over the newspapers, text Haiti to 90999, that's 90999, to donate $10 to the Red Cross. You can text the word Yele, which is Y-E-L-E, to 501501 to donate $5 to Yele Haiti's earthquake relief efforts, which I actually found out is a relief organization started by Wyclef Jean of the Fijis. You know, y'all know Wyclef. Y'all know Wyclef. And finally, you can text GIVE10, all one word, to 20222 to donate $10 to direct relief. I can't stress enough how important it is for, you know, everyone who's got a little bit to give that little bit to Haiti. All right, there you go. That's my little public service for the day. So let's move on with the show, shall we? On with the show. I got plenty to talk about. Most of it entertainment related, you know. I am nothing if not a pop culture fanatic, but let's start you out right here. Let's start you out with a little fun fact.
Fun fact!
See, folks, even when Colin's not here, his lovely voice is no more than a click away. So, today's fun fact is this. American Airlines saved $40,000 in 1987 by eliminating one olive from each salad served in first class. Just one olive. Now, this was back in 1987. I would assume that they've continued to carry on this practice. Certainly, any good business, they're gonna keep doing what saves the money, and it sounds like it's working. I mean, $40,000, that's not a small chunk of change. And definitely in today's troubling times, when so many of you find yourselves in such dire economic straits, I think we need to start praising frugality as our highest of virtues. I think what we need to do is learn from American Airlines' example. So here's my advice to you folks. In the future, from now on, when you make a salad, take a look at that salad. Take a good, long look at that salad, and if there are any olives in it, take one of those olives and throw it away. Just chuck it in the garbage or give it to the dog. I don't care. Get rid of it. It doesn't even matter what you do with it. Just get rid of that olive. And you know what? Bam! I just saved you $40,000. Don't thank me. You know? It's just what I do for you. You think I get paid for this? No? I don't get a cent from this, but that's okay. Because I'm saving so much money by throwing away olives. I am rolling in it, folks. Now, I know what you say, mo money, mo problems, but frankly, it seems to be working out for me, and I think it can for you as well. Pretty soon you're going to have an extra $40,000 in your pocket that you did not have before, thanks to American Airlines. And you know what? Have fun with it. You know, go buy a dirt bike. Go buy a big screen TV. Or, you know, I don't know if you're feeling generous, donate it to Haiti, because they could certainly use it. Well, frankly, they could probably use the olives, too. So maybe instead of throwing away the olives, you know, put them in a little baggie and mail them to Haiti. I don't know. Whatever. Just appreciate what you've got. And appreciate today's fun fact.
Fun fact!
So, this is going to come as a bit of a shock to you. I know, but I just got to say it. I have what you might call a surplus of free time at the moment. I know. Shocking. I know. It's quite a revelation to you. I know what you're thinking. I mean, here's a guy who's, you know, recording a podcast at 2 in the morning by himself. This sounds like a guy who's really got his shit together. I know. It's a little surprising, but yeah, I kind of have not a whole lot going on right now at the moment. I mean, it's winter break. You know, the semester doesn't start for a few weeks. I'm only working, like, you know, 10 hours a week, and I'm not taking any winter classes because that's more money out of my pocket that I don't really need to spend. So, you know, I gotta find something to do in my free time besides talking to people I can't see. And one of the things I have been doing is watching a lot of old TV shows. Some new TV shows. I started watching Mad Men, finally, at the, you know, suggestion of individuals. You know, I'll just say individuals, you know. I actually wanted to get a shirt from one of these individuals that just said, "You haven't seen Mad Men?" Well, now I can say I've seen it. I'm about, I don't know, 4 or 5 episodes into the first season. It's good, I'll give you that. But that's not what I'm here to talk about today. That's not what I want to talk about. What I do want to talk about are some, shall we say, blasts from the past. No. I don't want to say that because, you know, then I have to play the sound clip. Take me away, I don't mind, but you better promise me you'll get me back in time. Yeah, you know, that sound clip, except without me singing. I apologize for that. Probably not what you wanted to hear, but, whatevs. I did it. Can't take it back. I mean, I could, but, you know, I'm not going to. So the first of these, the first little gem that I've recently discovered is courtesy of our good friend Max, and that show is Farscape, or as I like to call it, Firefly with Muppets. I'm not exaggerating here. It's actually produced by the Jim Henson Company, and it's a great show. I mean, I'll say this: when you first see it, the first, you know, one or two, maybe even three episodes are going to seem really cheesy. Because there's Muppets and ridiculous-looking alien creatures walking around. I can see why it was a little obscure, because it does appear very cheesy. This is a show that aired back at the turn of the century. Aired from March 19th, 1999, through March 21st, 2003. So, you know, it's going on a decade old. It's going on 10 years old now. And certainly technology has advanced far beyond what it was at that point. I mean, the effects do seem a little bit cheesy. I know I've said that word a couple times, but I love cheese. I love it. It's my favorite food. And in this case, it adds to any dish, and in this case, I find that it really adds to Farscape. So once you get past the costumes, the kind of wonky CGI, or at least from today's perspective, you find that there's some really damn good TV going on here. Let me just go ahead and set it up for you. Now I'm still in the first season. Max bought the entire series on DVD. There's like 4 seasons, and there's also a 3-hour miniseries that comes after it called Farscape: The Peacekeeper Wars, which we're kind of a ways away from getting to, so we're about a little over halfway through the first season. So let me set it up for you. The main character, our hero, he's kind of your Harrison Ford, your kind of Han Solo type. He's kind of your adventurous guy. quite dreamy, I'll say that. He's a good-looking man, all right? I'm comfortable enough that I can say that Ben Browder, who plays our hero John Crichton, is a good-looking dude. He's got the skills to pay the bills. He's an American astronaut who he's you know, top of his field. He's a scientist. You know, I doubt there are scientists, real scientists, who actually look like that. But he is a scientist who's working on a fairly radical technique here. Basically, he's trying to slingshot around the Earth use the Earth's gravity, use the Earth's rotation to accelerate his self-designed spacecraft to speeds that were previously unattainable by human technology. I have no idea if that's actually feasible or if this is just some techno babble that they came up with the show. I'm not an astrophysicist. It's not something I would know. But whatever, it's sci-fi. We know that. We know going into this that it's going to be pretty implausible, pretty outlandish. So he ends up somehow creating a wormhole, or just a wormhole just happens to appear as he's doing this experiment. Basically gets sucked through a wormhole and pops him out in the middle of some other galaxy, who knows where. Of course, it's far, far away. Although I don't think it's a long time ago. At least I hope not. If I find out they end up bringing time travel into this, then I'm gonna be a little upset. Time travel really never improves anything. So, anyways, John Crichton pops out in the middle of an asteroid field, which is in the middle of a huge space battle with lasers and explosions going on between the Peacekeeper forces. Now, the Peacekeepers are the main antagonists of the show. They're kind of like a private military group that's, I don't know, they're like mercenaries or whatever. They're basically like the Alliance soldiers in Firefly. In fact, this show actually has a ton of similarities to Firefly, but actually Firefly premiered in 2002, so a couple years after Farscape premiered. But there's a ton of similarities. You've got the Alliance, which are, you know, the civilized central planets, and then you've got kind of the outer settlements, the kind of outlying worlds. And in Farscape, you've got the Peacekeepers, which come from, you know, the inner sector, the inner planets, I guess. They haven't really touched too far into that, because this show, like Firefly, takes place in Farscape. They're called the Uncharted Territories, but basically, in effect, the same thing as the outer planets in Firefly. The crews, you know, there's some similarities between the crew. You've got, you know, I haven't gotten to the crew. I gotta finish setting up. Basically, John Crichton finds himself in the middle of battle between the Peacekeepers and this one ship, the Leviathan. It's not called the Leviathan. It's a Leviathan, which is a living ship, whose name is Moya, that's flown by a kind of symbiotic being just called Pilot. Yes, this is all sounding very nerdy, I know, but if you're like me, then you're really into this stuff. So, basically, this is a living ship that had been taken over by Peacekeepers. It was a former Peacekeeper vessel carrying prisoners who had now escaped and taken over the ship. And I'm guessing killed all the Peacekeepers on board. So there's Dargo, who is a Luxant warrior, and the Luxants are basically Twi'leks on steroids. And if you're a Star Wars fan, you will know what a Twi'lek is. And, you know, they're the proud, they're honorable warriors. They all, you know, they're obsessed with battle and honor and, you know, slaying their enemies and, you know, all that sort of thing. And he's basically the equivalent of Jane in Firefly. Then, of course, you've got Zan, who is a female of the blue-skinned Delvian race, who's very similar to Inara. She's known as a priestess. She's from a special order, just like Inara is a companion. And like Inara, she's very beautiful, very graceful. She's trained in a number of skills and arts, many of them sensual in nature. And, you know, she fills that kind of diplomatic, graceful, but also, in many cases, very dangerous in her own right role that Inara filled in Firefly. And I don't want to waste too much time on this, so I'll hurry this along. There's Rigel, who is, he's a Muppet. I don't really feel like describing him, but he's small, and he floats around in a little chair. He's Dominar Rigel the 16th, deposed emperor of the Hynerian Empire, and he's very foul-mouthed, ill-tempered, greedy. He's pretty much the comic relief of the show. And then finally you've got Erin Sun, who is a former peacekeeper who has now thrown her lot in with these outlaws. And I guess I should mention John Crichton gets picked up by the Leviathan ship and joins these guys. Erin is a former peacekeeper and, of course, the only other human, except not really, because apparently in this galaxy there are no humans. There are a slightly different species called the Sabatians, who are pretty much human in every way, although there actually are some pretty key differences between humans and Sabatians that I'm not going to go into because it's not really that interesting right now. And of course you know right off the bat that, you know, John and Erin are going to end up hooking up. But I gotta say, the sexual tension in this show, even, you know, as blatant as it is, I find it really well done. Like, you know, it's such a kind of obvious thing to have in a sci-fi show. I mean, but I actually really enjoy it, and the show's great. I mean, it's if you liked Firefly, you're gonna love Farscape, because it's that same thing. It's this group of ragtag, you know, characters all from different backgrounds, all with secrets, you know, all with hidden pasts, who are kind of stuck together on this very, very unique ship, and they're on the run, they're outlaws, they're going to different settlements, getting into crazy adventures every single day. It's another thing, you know, and John, as the human, is always kind of ridiculed and mocked for being of a primitive species, but he's a scientist, and he's the only one who seems to get shit done on a day-to-day basis. So I gotta say, Farscape is great. If you love Jim Henson and his wondrous creations, you're gonna love the things he's doing here, because great costumes, great creature effects. I gotta say, I mean, the guy knows what he's doing when it comes to making these Muppets, you know, actually seem like lifelike characters and actually fit with the human actors. And I gotta say, the interplay between the humans and the Muppets, pretty well done. The costumes, I would say, are actually the weakest part, because, I mean, everything in this world is humanoid, or in this show is humanoid, and the makeup is pretty obvious. It probably could have used a little more work, but I'm willing, like I said, if you're willing to see past the cheese, then you have got several, and I mean several, hours of great TV ahead of you. Max and I have just gotten hooked on watching it. And it is so much fun to watch. The writing is actually, for a sci-fi show, actually, no, just for a show, it's great writing. The dialogue, I really enjoy it. The plots are always interesting. I was always amazed at the things they come up with, even though, you know, like Star Trek, many things are just kind of obvious rip-offs of other texts. But nonetheless, Farscape, little gem that no one watched. I hadn't even heard of it, but a great sci-fi for you.
My name is John Crichton, an astronaut.
A radiation wave hit, and I got shot through a wormhole.
Now I'm lost in some distant part of the universe on a ship, a living ship, full of strange alien life forms. Help me. Listen, please. Is there anybody out there who can hear me?
I'm being hunted by an insane military commander,
doing everything I can.
I'm just looking for a way home.
Oh boy, that got pretty nerdy there. I realize that got pretty geeky there. That's okay. Because the next show I want to talk about will have a little more mass appeal. I'm talking about Judd Apatow's Undeclared. I'm a pretty late in covering this. There's probably a lot of people out there who have actually seen this and will no doubt second this motion that Undeclared is fantastic. Probably, definitely one of the most entertaining shows I've watched recently. Just in terms of just, oh my god, everything about it. Just from start to finish. I mean, it only lasted one season, much like Apatow's previous show, Freaks and Geeks. Also, just a wonderful show. And they only lasted one season, which is regrettable. But at the same time, I kind of think maybe it's for the best that those shows only got one season. A second season would have really been great for both. But either way, my point is sometimes it's better that things end while they're good rather than, you know, having to watch them get dragged out and just become, you know, twisted, unfunny versions of their mere shadows of their former selves, if you want to say that. Now, I have no idea if this is true or not, but it seems to me, just at first glance, that Freaks and Geeks might have been the more well-known of the two. So that's why I'm talking about Undeclared here. But you absolutely need to watch both shows. There's absolutely no excuse not to get both shows on DVD because, like I said, they're each only one season. And Undeclared is also a little more relevant to me because it's about college kids rather than high school kids. And it, you know, takes place during more modern times than Freaks and Geeks, which took place during the 80s. And I'm not a freshman anymore. But it's really uncanny. I gotta say, it's really uncanny how much of the stuff in Undeclared, to me at least, actually mirrors, you know, actual experience. Like, you watch a lot of shows, a lot of high school shows, and a lot of, you know, shows about college students, and you're just like, none of that would ever happen. Like, that's just so over the top. It's so ridiculous that you can't really relate to it because it's such a caricature. All the things are just made up. They're just the kind of things people say about college that don't actually happen. I actually found a lot of the things in Undeclared actually were things that I could relate to. And I'll get the things that are too over the top out of the way first. The fact that they're freshmen, but they live in a dorm. You know, they clearly live in a dorm, but their rooms are like, their rooms are nicer than my apartment. I mean, they have like full kitchens. Their rooms are huge. I mean, I do get my own room in my apartment, so that's the one difference. But pretty sweet digs. I mean, maybe that'd be true if I was going to a more expensive college, or maybe that's just kind of you know how in all sitcoms they always show. You know, even in like really middle class or people who clearly couldn't afford that sort of lifestyle, the people in sitcoms always live in just the nicest homes because, you know, they're trying to, at the end of the day, they're trying to sell shit to you. So they're always going to show people living in nicer digs than actual people would live in. And I'm guessing this is probably the case for the kids in Undeclared. But either way, and there are some things that are intentionally over the top. Like, for example, the episode about the inevitable fraternity episode, of course, is about hazing. It's actually a two-part episode where the main character gets fed up with his roommates and decides to go rush Theta Delta Zeta fraternity. Now that, again, like, there are so many things I can relate to. I mean, one of the reasons, I am in a fraternity. I am in the Alpha Epsilon Pi fraternity. And, I experienced a little bit of what the character in that show, experienced. When I'm talking about not the hazing, of course. Hazing was certainly never a part of my fraternity experience, and really, despite what popular culture would have you believe, not a part of most people's fraternal experiences. But what I did experience is the disapproval and subtle, sometimes not even that subtle, condescension of the other people who lived on my floor. Certainly not going to name names, but there were individuals who, you know, very kind of, very obvious about that they had very stereotypical opinions of fraternities. And I'll admit that I may have had some of that prior disposition going into college. I know it's common because of all the, you know, the movies that we see, like Animal House, certainly being first and foremost in most people's kind of collective view of fraternities. It's, at least for me, it's not Animal House. It's far from it. But as far as the people I lived with were concerned, I was now a drunken frat boy. Of course, the fraternity in Undeclared that the character joins is certainly the much more stereotypical image of the fraternity, with the crazy hazing, the crazy crazy shit that they make their pledges do. And that actually was a fantastic episode, though, because the pledge master, or what was his title in the show? He was the sage of the Theta Delta Zeta fraternity, was played superbly by Sam Levine, who was in Freaks and Geeks. He was Neil Schreiber in Freaks and Geeks. And he was also recently in Inglourious Basterds. Love that guy. He is just a fantastic, fantastic actor. Hilarious. And honestly, that brings me to what I love most about Undeclared. The casting. Oh my god, the casting. This is... Everybody's in this show. I mean, the main cast... The main character is played by Jay Baruchel. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name, but you may recognize him from Tropic Thunder, where he was the kind of unknown actor, the kind of tag-along, kind of, you know, neurotic, kind of nerdy guy. And he's pretty much exactly the same guy in this, just a couple years younger. And then, of course, you've got Seth Rogen, and honestly, for most of you, that's probably enough to get you watching right there. Seth Rogen actually wrote or co-wrote a number of the episodes as well. And he's very much Seth Rogen in this. He's not quite as sarcastic as he was in Freaks and Geeks. I mean, in Freaks and Geeks, he was, like, downright nihilistic sometimes, but he's still got that scathing wit that he's so popularized him, and he's great in this show. Not quite a main character, but certainly a recurring character, Jason Segel plays this guy, Eric, who is the former boyfriend of one of the main characters, Lizzie, who is, you know, your obsessive, love-struck, deadbeat, older guy boyfriend who works in a copy shop and, you know, pretty much does nothing but sit around all day and obsess over her. But what I love about this show is the cameos. The cameos are simply delightful. I will tell you one thing about Judd Apatow you really gotta give him credit for is he knows how to pick people. He knows how to pick them. Because it seems like everyone who works with him goes on to find success. Like, just about everyone in Freaks and Geeks went on to have a successful career. You know, sort of Seth Rogen, James Franco, you know, all those guys. And there's plenty of Freaks and Geeks alumni showing up in here. Sam Levine, I already mentioned. Martin Starr, who was Bill in Freaks and Geeks, definitely the best character on that show, shows up. The girl who played Kim also shows up, and just a lot of other people who were there on Freaks and Geeks. But just the cameos who show up, and these are a lot of people. This was before their heyday, which is why I say Judd Apatow really knows how to pick them. So let's just run down the list here. We got Jenna Fischer, before she was Pam in The Office. Simon Helberg, who's in Big Bang Theory, Fred Willard, Ted Nugent, actually in an unaired episode, Adam Sandler shows up in one episode along with his two lackeys, Alan Covert and Jonathan Lochran, who are in, you know, Adam Sandler always puts the same people in his movies, and they also apparently have to follow him when he makes TV appearances. Will Ferrell shows up in an episode. Felicia Day. Ben Stiller. Kyle Gass from Tenacious D shows up in a couple episodes, along with Amy Poehler. That one old Indian dude who is in 40-Year-Old Virgin and Zach and Miri Make a Porno, he's there. Crazy, old, and Indian. So we're talking about a who's who of comedy here. I mean, that's not to mention all the directors. We're talking about such notable directors as Jon Favreau, who's made Swingers, Iron Man, ring a bell. Jake Kasdan directed the films Walk Hard and Orange County. Nicholas Stoller, who directed Forgetting Sarah Marshall. John Hamburg, who directed I Love You Man, Along Came Polly, and Broken Lizards, Jay Chandrasekhar, who is, of course, the Indian guy in the Broken Lizard films, such as Super Troopers and Beer Fest. So yeah, inspired casting, fantastic dialogue, just some hilarious situations, and frankly, if you are a college student, I guarantee you will find at least one thing in an episode of Undeclared that reminds you of your own misadventures. So, Undeclared, Farscape, that's, if you find yourself, you know, like me, in the next couple weeks and have a little bit of extra free time, why don't you, hop on down and, you know, get yourself a copy of Farscape and Undeclared, and Freaks and Geeks while you're at it, you know, if you haven't seen that one, because, folks, you do not know what you're missing. So I'm now going to take a little break here and play Solid by the Dandy Warhols, which is actually the opening theme music for Undeclared.
Yeah.
All right, and we're back. That was, once again, Solid by the Dandy Warhols, which is actually the opening theme music to Undeclared. So now we have a special guest with us, my good friend, my esteemed colleague, Evan Rosenberg.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Justin.
Awesome. How's it going, man?
It's going well. It's going very well.
Fantastic.
Kicking off Y2K10, right?
You know? Yeah, man. We know what we're doing.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to be talking about a little movie I saw.
Very small
week.
Movie.
Sadly, yes, in terms of the coverage that it's getting. I'm talking about The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Right, which is another name for Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium.
Right. Not to be confused with Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium, which is a piece of utter garbage. But I'll get to that.
I have not seen either movie.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, so you're just going off name alone. You're just going off name basis.
Well, I think an Imaginarium and a Wonder Emporium are probably the same thing.
You would think so. Thankfully, they were not, because I've seen both movies. I can give you an accurate portrayal of what they're both about. But let me start out my review like this. When the movie ended, I'm talking about The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which just came out. When the movie ended, credits started rolling. My very first reaction was, this movie made no sense whatsoever. Then I see, directed by Terry Gilliam, pops up on the screen.
Uh-huh.
And I go, that makes sense. That makes sense that it didn't make sense. Now, I love Terry Gilliam. I'll say that.
As do I. I was telling you earlier, I actually have a copy of 12 Monkeys on HD DVD.
That is probably a distinction that most people cannot claim.
True.
I guess you bet on the wrong horse, but...
Well, I got Blu-ray as well. It's kind of like having, a copy of Baron von Munchausen on Laserdisc.
Sure. Well, now we just use those for Frisbees.
Right.
So, here's the thing. I mean, it's utterly regrettable to me that almost no one has even heard of this movie. I mean, because we're talking about some pretty high-profile actors in this movie. Let me just run down the list here. So we got... it is, of course, Heath Ledger's last film. This is the film that Heath Ledger died.
Heath Ledger died?
While making. Yep. Sorry. I know this is going to come as a shock to you and to many of our listeners.
I'm going to have to take a moment while you continue with your review.
All right. Just wipe the tears from your eyes and in memoriam, shall we say.
Well, yes. Our good friend Heath Ledger.
In memoriam, Evan will take a moment of silence while I keep talking. So, yeah, Heath Ledger died. It's regrettable. And when Terry Gilliam got the call that Ledger had regrettably passed on, he was immediately just like, all right, shut it down. Movie's over. We're done. But he was convinced to press on. So he did something rather unorthodox here. And actually got three different actors to sort of replace Heath Ledger in certain scenes of the movie. And those actors were Johnny Depp, Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell. None of whom look particularly like Heath Ledger.
No. I mean, the first two, I guess I can see a little bit, sort of similarities.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure on Colin Farrell.
That's the thing. The way they did it, and I know this sounds ridiculous, this is going to sound ridiculous to people, but it actually, he pulls it off better than you would expect. Because basically how it works is, and let me just give you the brief setup for the movie. Dr. Parnassus is this, he was this kind of like monk living in a secluded temple who, made a wager with the devil for immortality.
Okay.
And the devil in this movie is played by none other than Tom Waits.
I may have to actually go see this movie.
I'm telling you, man, just for Tom Waits. Tom Waits is incredible. Every single moment that Tom Waits is on screen, I could not look away.
There was, not to bring this off track, but there was a discussion recently on a message board that we actually both frequent, the Maximum Fun Board, about Tom Waits specifically, how do Tom Waits fans feel about Tom Waits acting? And
How do they feel?
I've got it. Well, it's been across the board. Some people say, well, I love his singing, but, I don't really want to see him act. I feel like, I love seeing him act.
I mean, I have to be honest. I'm I wasn't a Tom Waits fan going into this. I know because, you know, Matt and Max and a lot of people I am friends with are big fans of Tom Waits. I don't think I've ever actually heard any of his songs.
Honestly, I just kind of assumed you were a Tom Waits fan, you know, just...
I didn't want to feel left out.
Because, you know, like, everybody he lives with likes Tom Waits. I like Tom Waits. I was like, oh, Justin likes Tom
Waits. You'd think at some point I would have heard Tom Waits. I haven't. And I didn't know who that was going into the movie. I was just like, who is this guy? And where did he get such an incredibly alluring voice?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a... there was a really great description that I saw somewhere, but I forgot, so that's completely useless. Point is, Tom Waits has a really cool voice.
Yes.
And he plays this role perfectly. Which is apparently a role that was adapted from his own play. Apparently he wrote a play using his own music, and this was a character that he'd created, Mr. Nick, who's the devil. So he makes a wager with this Dr. Parnassus guy for immortality. Now, their wager is thus, whoever can collect the most souls is the winner of the wager. Now, this is not really explained ever, and really it's probably not important that it is, but Dr. Parnassus has this mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And when people walk through this mirror, they are taken into literally their own imagination. So every person who goes into the mirror enters a different world.
Now, would you call this mirror an imaginarium?
You would.
Okay.
They call it that.
Sounds
that's
great.
That's what it's called.
Awesome.
It says imaginarium right there. Big, bold letters.
Sounds great.
Can't miss it. So, the imaginarium scenes are amazing. I would actually venture to say that, to me at least, and this does depend on whether you're into this sort of thing, this sort of really out there kind of art style with all sorts of weird... You know what it actually reminds me of? And I don't know how many people are going to get this reference. Kind of reminded me of Monkey Bone a little bit.
Okay.
Did you ever see Monkey Bone?
Not in whole.
That kind of very bizarre, just that, you know, crazy shapes and weird objects all over the place. To me, I actually found it more visually impressive than Avatar.
Okay.
Now, certainly you can't compare the technology. I'm aware of that. I mean, there's no contest between, you know, Avatar being like one of the most expensive movies ever made and this being, you know, a movie that no one's ever heard of.
Well, that there may be something said there, though, in the fact that spending a whole lot less money, Terry Gilliam is, you know, able to make something even more visually stunning because he's got just immense skill.
Yeah, he's just a brilliant filmmaker. Absolutely, absolutely. I think Avatar, as amazing as it is, once you adjust to it,
mm-hmm.
you know, once you get used to seeing it, it's sort of it's not as impressive because yes, the technology that they are using is impressive, but what they're actually using it to create.
Well, there are some people out there, you know, suffering from immense depression who would beg to differ that.
Right.
Having seen it, still, you know, the
post-Avatar depression.
The rest of the world doesn't look as impressive.
Yeah, people who are like, oh, I saw Avatar, now the real world isn't nearly as colorful as or vibrant. I mean,
yeah,
get out of here with that nonsense.
I can't plug my hair into things.
Yeah. I don't want to go down that road, frankly. But I will say this: if you're doubting me, just go give Imagineer. You should see it anyways. I mean, just for who's in it.
You sold me. I'm going to have to go see it.
Yeah, just for Tom Waits alone, I think everyone needs to see it.
I did not realize Tom Waits was in it.
So within this Imaginarium, Heath Ledger plays this kind of sort of roguish, you know, kind of charming, you know, kind of trickster fellow.
He's Dr. Parnassus?
No, he's not Dr. Parnassus.
Okay.
Christopher Plummer is Dr. Parnassus.
Okay.
Great actor as well. And really, you know, he's not stealing the spotlight or anything, but he is really the anchor. Like, if he hadn't done his role as well as he did, all the other roles would not nearly mesh as well as they did. Especially because when Heath Ledger goes into the Imaginarium for the first time, and I don't know, maybe this is giving things away, but I've kind of already said how this works. When Heath Ledger goes into the Imaginarium, his persona in the Imaginarium is represented by these other three actors,
uh-huh.
and that's how they pull it off. And the transition, the very first time he goes in, when it goes from Heath Ledger to Johnny Depp, it actually, you kind of have to double take it, it, you know, you don't realize it at first, and then you're like, wait, this, that's not Heath Ledger anymore.
Hmm.
So it works out. Had I known this, I didn't really know that much going into this movie, and I imagine most people didn't either. But it's pretty interesting that it has gotten so little publicity, considering how much, you know, attention Heath Ledger got.
Yeah, well,
for Dark Knight.
It says something about, you know, the fickleness of people, you know, in regards to death and.
Yeah, because yeah. I mean, you know, 2 years ago or whatever, it was all the talk of the town. Now this is because people, I think there are probably people out there who think Dark Knight was his last role.
Yeah,
and
absolutely, you know, I've heard people say it.
Yeah, and you know. It was not. And now this was nowhere near as iconic a role mm-hmm. as the Joker. I'm not going to say that it was.
He didn't even do the whole role himself. How could it be so iconic?
Well, yeah, and it, probably not the role, you know, you'd want to go out on. But it was still pretty fine performance. I think of the three replacement actors who came in, Colin Farrell probably. It did the weakest, I think. Also, just because he looks the most dissimilar
right.
to Heath Ledger.
Was there anyone else considered, you know, other than those three?
Yes. Apparently, Tom Cruise asked if he could be one of the actors.
Oh, wow.
Filling in for Heath Ledger. And Terry Gilliam actually said, no, you were not friends with Heath. You don't get to be in my movie.
You know, Terry just didn't know about their secret tryst.
Maybe, but that's... I don't know who I lose more respect for in that case, but I'll tell you this, though, about Tom Cruise, a little factoid that I love. This was actually in the recent edition of the Guinness Book of World Records. Apparently, Tom Cruise holds the record for the most overpaid actor in the world.
I believe it.
Because if you compare how much he gets paid to how much his movies make,
right.
He's the most, and I think Nicole Kidman is the most overpaid actress.
Well, that just makes perfect sense right there.
It really does. And frankly, that delights me to no end.
There's a great song from Jonathan Coulton. Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy.
maybe I'll dig that up. Maybe I'll dig that up. I haven't decided what our last song's going to be, but...
Oh, okay.
I
was suggesting it more for the fans.
Sure.
Or the listeners.
Listeners out there.
Your listeners are fans of you. You
know? I would assume so. I would hope so.
You got like three guys in a basement somewhere, and they're just like, oh, we hate this guy. Let's listen to the show so we can hate him more.
Well, hopefully I'm not giving them too much fodder. But if you're a fan of Jonathan Coulton and you're a fan of me, then listen to Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise Crazy. And also, while you're at it, check out some other Terry Gilliam films.
Yes.
I gotta say, Terry Gilliam might be one of, if not the, my favorite actor. Favorite director.
Right.
Although he is an actor too, he was in Monty Python.
Yeah, well, I thought he did mostly the animation. I think he did a bit of acting, but he wasn't.
He was still part of the troupe.
Yeah, he was part of the troupe, but he wasn't necessarily. You know, his strength wasn't in acting, but he did a bit.
Yeah, he was actually the only non-British member of the Monty Python troupe. He was actually American-born.
Right. Did he have British citizenship at the time yet?
Or? Yeah, he got British citizenship later, but he was actually. From America, which I think a lot of people might not know also.
He's the one member that the BNP would want to kick out, except not really because he's white.
Yeah. Well, we'll give him the benefit.
There I go with my British politics jokes again.
We'll give him the benefit of the doubt, I guess. I mean, he's... Let's run him down. Let's run him down. We got 12 Monkeys.
Right.
Brazil.
Right.
We got...
The documentary he made on Munchausen Syndrome.
Yes. And also the movie about the movie about his failure to make The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
Right.
Just one of like the biggest, you know, disasters in filmmaking history. He did make the Brothers Grimm, you know, everyone gets one strike against them.
Sure.
But mainly what I remember him for. Well, he also made The Fisher King, great film. But my favorite Terry Gilliam film by far has to be Brazil.
Brazil, where hearts were entertaining
Jim. Hmm?
Huh?
Did, no. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Don't ask questions.
So, yeah, Brazil.
Brazil. One of the things that I love about Brazil, and it's famous for, is its ambiguous ending, which they notoriously changed to make it, you know, all happy, happy sunshine.
Right.
But the original ending was incredibly ambiguous, incredibly dark, and while the Imaginarium, the ending is definitely a happy ending, definitely a lot of ambiguity to it.
Mm-hmm.
When the movie ended, I was like, you know, I could make a case that this whole movie was basically just the fantasy of a drunken bum.
Okay.
And, you know, if you watch...
That drunken bum being Tom Waits?
Right.
Okay.
Well, his voice does sound like it's been, you know, soaked in moonshine for, yeah, like, three moons.
He's got songs about being a drunken bum. I'm not putting him down. I'm just characterizing him by his music.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you watch it, there's a lot that could suggest that it's just all in his head. And I think a little similarly in The Fisher King, which, for those of you who haven't seen that, that's basically Robin Williams is a homeless guy who is on a quest for the Holy Grail.
Of course.
And Jeff Bridges aids him in a quest to seek redemption.
Okay.
For his sins. It's Robin Williams, you know, and he's kind of... I frankly like Robin Williams better, actually, when he's just being more serious, and less when he's just being kind of goofy.
Yeah.
But it's got some comedic elements, but it's definitely not... It's a serious movie. It's a pretty dark movie in its own right. But actually, Terry Gilliam, another fun fact about him while we're on the subject.
Sure.
Terry Gilliam was actually J.K. Rowling's first choice to direct the Harry Potter films.
I might have actually enjoyed those films then.
Absolutely. And Terry Gilliam was pissed when he didn't get the films. I mean, I don't remember who. Christopher something, I think.
Christopher Reeve,
direct. Yeah, well, that, there you go.
You know, the man was a great actor. He deserves a lot of respect. But, you know, you don't give a directing job out of pity.
How do you run a cast when you can't stand up?
How do you run a cast when you can't run?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for saying the thing that...
You're welcome.
I wouldn't.
Yes.
I wouldn't go there.
Everybody's thinking it. Nobody's talking. Let's talk about Christopher Reeve being horribly handicapped.
I didn't go there, despite the fact that the little catchphrase on the Facebook fan page says, boldly going nowhere. That's right. We went there.
Right.
I didn't go there. I had to get you to come in and step in and show us how things were done.
That's how it is. You know, when I'm doing my own show, you know, I'm very, you know, held back, reserved. You know, I like to be very proper. When I'm on somebody else's show, I am fucking shit up.
That you are, Evan. That you are, and we definitely appreciate it. I think that's a good note to end this.
Well, I
conversation.
Have one last question for you.
Certainly.
Would you say that Dr. Parnassus is the Dr. Pepper to Mr. Megorium's Mr. Pibb?
Oh, by far.
Okay.
Not even Diet Dr. Pepper. He's the real deal. He is the real McCoy.
Right.
I gotta say, man.
Sounds good. I'm gonna have to see this movie.
If you like crazy fantasies with some really high-profile actors and a little bit of that Terry Gilliam brilliance in there, well, a whole lot of that Terry Gilliam brilliance in there, Imaginarium, definitely give it a look before it, you know, disappears forever. Because I think it might have only gotten a limited release too. But it is actually playing at Arundel Mills, so. Huh. Maybe it got a little wider release than I thought.
Yeah.
So, Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus in theaters now.
That was the problem. One of my favorite movies of last year was limited release, so I'm the only one who saw it.
Which was that?
Moon.
We're going to watch that, right?
Yeah, so I've got it on Blu-ray now.
Yeah.
So
I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah.
It's got Sam Rockwell in
Sam
it,
Sam Rockwell. Kevin Spacey voices the robot.
I'm down, man. I'm down. Other limited release that I hope... Probably also out on DVD now that we could watch. It might get loud.
I may finally watch that. Yeah,
it's a documentary, but it was a hell of a packs a real punch, you know. Now we're done talking about movies.
Okay.
Now it's time to talk about something a little more unfortunate. We have come to the point in today's show where we have to get it out in the open. We have to discuss today's spectacle of human failure.
There are white folks, and then there are ignorant motherfuckers like you.
Okay, so today's spectacle of human failure is the Transportation Security Administration.
Oh, the TSA.
The TSA. This article on Sphere.com, once again linked to by our friends at AOL.
Of course. Friends and mine.
Right. I love AOL. I love their because what AOL considers news and what you and I consider news aren't always the same thing.
Right.
But it is always entertaining. For example, this one. 8-year-old Mikey stuck on terror watch list. Now, let me just read the opening paragraph. 8-year-old Michael Hicks isn't your typical third grader. He's a Cub Scout, a junior black belt, and a big fan of BMX bikes. He's also a name on the Transportation Security Administration's Selectee Watch List.
Now, if I may chime in, other than being on the terror watch list...
Oh, you may chime in.
Thank you. Other than being on the terror watch list, that does sound like your typical 8-year-old. Cub Scouts, you know, martial arts,
BMX bikes.
I don't see how that's atypical.
I guess being a black belt at 8-year-old, that's...
Junior black belt, yeah.
Is junior black belt, is that as in, like, the one below black belt, or is that black belt for kids?
It might be black belt for kids.
So, like, yeah. Like, maybe black overalls.
Could be. Like, black diaper.
Yeah. The black diapers.
Yeah. Here's the thing, I was thinking about this the other day, and I was going to save it for my show, but I'll go ahead and, talk about it on yours.
Oh, he's bringing in A-list material now.
Yeah, I'm bringing, you know, the real material. There's a lot of energy in prepubescent boys who are not, you know, particularly athletic in conventional sports.
All right.
And I was thinking about this more in terms of, you know, how can we solve, you know, the crises that our nation currently faces. This thing, we take charge of these boys, because you get these little boys who, you know, the ones who aren't expelling all their energy in, you know, like soccer and baseball and... you know, curling and all that.
Curling, right.
Right. Real big among 8-year-olds. 8-year-olds and Canadians.
Of course.
Right. And
They have about similar mental faculties.
8-year-old Canadians? Crazy for it.
Oh, shit, man. You don't even want to go there.
Right. But these kids get so obsessed with things, you know, like they catch on to minutiae. They know so much completely needless information because they've got all this energy that... in a few years, they're going to be putting towards, you know, women,
mm-hmm.
but they're not yet interested in women.
Right. Were you making some sort of suggestion, or is this just a comment
on this general
phenomenon?
Making an observation. The fact that he's, you know, that he's a junior black belt. Well, of course he's a junior black belt, because he's not spending his Friday nights, you know, out trying to meet ladies. He's spending his Friday nights practicing his high kick.
Right, although I don't know, that junior black belt's going to pay off when he, you know, does try and start meeting women.
Oh, sure, but he that's not why he did it.
But I think what you may not realize that you're getting here is that we need to find a way to harness this energy
right.
for our own nefarious purposes.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, if we could take, you know, if we could get 8-year-olds to spend as much, you know, of their time and energy to, I don't know, solving... world hunger as they did to, you know, collecting Pokemon cards.
And learning, you know, the history of Aerosmith.
Right. Think about what we could do.
But there's just one problem with the plan, though.
We could create an army of prepubescent 8-year-olds.
The problem
who
is...
who know karate.
Collecting those 8-year-old boys, getting in contact with them? Not really easy.
That's true, and it doesn't help that most of them are already on terrorist watch lists.
True.
Like Michael Hicks. And honestly, what jumped out at me first about this article is the photograph.
Right.
This could not be a more sensationalist article, I think, if they tried. I mean, let's... You want to go ahead and paint the picture for us. Describe what you are looking at here, Evan.
What I'm looking at here appears to be a child's room. There's a child standing in the... you know, sort of on the right side of the photo, more in the bottom half than in the top half, because he's a child and not very tall.
Naturally.
He is wearing his Cub Scouts uniform. I believe that is a bear neckerchief.
It's hard to tell, but...
It's blue-colored. I believe that's bear.
Yeah.
I want to say the wolf is yellow, and Weebelos is, of course, a different blue.
Right.
Although it appears he may have his Weebelos badge, so I don't know.
That looks like empty space there on the right.
Right side, which I believe that's where the bear goes.
Yeah. Well, you sure? Because he's got the he's definitely got a patch on the bottom.
Yes. He's got some he's got some arrow points.
All right.
I see one gold, one silver. There may be more being hidden.
So you've described this child's attire.
His attire. But there's a bit more about his attire that needs to be said, though. You know, he is wearing his hat cocked to the side, which honestly points against him, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
He also has glasses because, you know, he's a little kid with glasses. Looks like sort of a bowl haircut, and he does not look very happy.
Yeah, that's. I wanted to get at that expression. There's something about that expression,
right?
That I think is just so. It just screams fabricated to me. Like I know they told him to This picture was not done by accident. You know what I mean? This was clearly framed. They've got the caution kid zone in the back behind all his trophies.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, that may be why he's on the watch list. You know, they just took the sign to heart.
Take caution.
The thing I want to point out here, you know, behind him is his dresser with all his trophies on top, and it looks like some medals piled there as well. Look at the bottom of the dresser, though.
Yep, drawers. The drawer's still open.
I can't tell if it's open or there's something stuck there. I mean, this kid, you know, doesn't keep his room as neat as maybe he should. Maybe he's having a photographer coming over.
That's true. He clearly a very cavalier attitude.
Yeah.
Towards this whole picture taking process.
Fame has gotten to his head.
Absolutely. I mean, and he's probably proud of the fact that he's on a watch list because it means people are watching him, and I think that he's an attention whore.
Yes.
He's clearly an attention whore. Look at those.
Like attention.
The trophies, the ribbons, the uniform.
The hat. He's peacocking with that hat.
That's true. You know, he could have just... With all the attention to detail they put into this picture, there's no reason they could have just told him, hey, fix your hat, damn it.
Yeah.
But he's like, this is my statement, man. I want people to know who Mikey is.
How I wear my hat, man.
That's how I roll.
Because that's how he talks. He watched too much LEG.
And that's why he's on the terror watch list.
Yes.
I think anyone who's ever watched LEG is probably on a terror watch list or some sort of watch list.
Yes. I myself am on the neighborhood watch list.
There you go.
That's what happens when you try to, you know, recruit 8-year-old boys for your personal army.
For your personal army, right. Don't do that anymore.
Right.
You're going to end up on you're going to end up on more than a watch list. I can tell you that. You're going to end up on, like, To Catch a Predator or something.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be a crazy misunderstanding?
This is just a hilarious misunderstanding.
I didn't want to have sex with him. I was going to ask him to help me solve world hunger.
Solving world hunger with children.
Hey, there's a solution.
Isn't that, what is that thing that that essay, that like satirical piece, an interesting proposition or something?
Oh yeah,
written guy. I think it was written by the guy who wrote Gulliver's Travels.
Yeah, I think so.
He wrote this essay saying how we could solve hunger by cooking and eating children.
Proposition, I think, was part of the
album. Something proposition.
Modest proposal. A modest proposal.
Bam! Right there. I hope they heard that high five.
Yes, I
hope
so.
I heard it. So
we're not watching the levels anymore, because we're busy looking at the picture of Mikey.
I can't look away, man. But frankly speaking, I have a modest proposal for the TSA. Here's my modest proposal for the TSA. Pull your damn heads out of your asses.
I agree.
I mean,
you know, I appreciate the work the TSA is attempting to do. You know, I say this because I'm considering trying to get a job with them in the near future.
Well, I was thinking this might almost be somewhat of a conflict of interest for me, considering that my dad works for the organization that oversees the TSA.
Right, but we're not sitting here saying we don't need a TSA. What we're saying is that the TSA needs to get on the ball. The problem that I see with TSA is that they always seem to be focusing on whatever the last issue was, rather than working preventatively.
They're incredibly reactionary.
Yes.
And that's not the way to go preventing things from happening.
Well, take the underwear bomber, for instance.
Yeah.
The underwear bomber was...
Who was mentioned right here, all-suspected underwear bomber, Umar Farouk Abdul-Muttalib, breezed through security without incident on Christmas Day. Mikey, a bespectacled boy from Clifton, New Jersey, finds himself frisked each time he tries to board a plane.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say is the underwear bomber, not very different, other than, you know, location, from the shoe bomber.
Mm-hmm.
But...
Yeah, underwear and shoes go in different places.
Right. Well, yeah, clearly. But rather than taking a lesson from the shoe bomber to look for, you know, explosives on people, they took a lesson to search people's shoes.
Right.
So the underwear bomber gets through free, because I'm sure he took off his shoes, had no explosives in his shoes, so he was fine.
They're just like, well, no one told us to look at the underwear, too.
Yeah, and it's not that they should look in his underwear, but maybe get a, you know, whatever, you know, the scent of that, you know, particular substance is. You know, get some dogs sniffing for that stuff. Get, you know, some way to try to detect it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a matter of they seem to look specifically at whatever the last case was. Somebody brought some sort of, you know, ignitable liquid on a plane. Okay, well, nobody can bring any liquids rather than, you know, let's look into what's ignitable and work in a greater preventative manner.
Right. I mean, and sometimes they take things too far in one direction, and sometimes... Oh, I like this line, by the way. Here's some great journalism for you. Mikey received his first pat-down at age 2. Not surprisingly, he cried. Is it important that we know that? That he cried? I don't...
No. Well, it's clearly a very biased piece. And in all honesty, you know, despite the fact that Mikey looks like a bit of a douche...
kind of a douche. He does look kind of a douchey kid.
And it's mostly the hat. It is mostly that.
Yeah.
But despite the fact
Well, he's not the only one, though. He's not the only one. 8-year-old Charlie.
I was just
going
to say, before you get to the next guy.
Okay.
Despite the fact that Mikey looks like a bit of a douche, I do side with him here. We shouldn't have 8-year-olds on a terror watch list unless there's a real reason other than just, oh, you know, there's a terrorist named Mikey.
Well, according to a TSA spokesman, quote, there are no children on the no-fly or selectee list. This is just willfully ignorance.
I'm a Dinashad, so that there were no gays in Iran.
If we're comparing 8-year-olds to
gays,
well,
I'm already on some watch list just from what I've said so far in the show.
I'll just say, in reference to one of these groups, I won't say which one, but honestly, who needs them?
Yeah, who needs agree. Them? I know exactly what you mean, and I agree.
Yeah, you know which group I'm talking about.
Yes.
I don't know, man. TSA are just kind of an embarrassment in and of themselves.
Especially when you look at, you know, like Israeli airport security, you know, who deal with actual, you know, like impending terrorist threats all the time and know how to handle it.
Yeah. Well, thankfully there's some hope, because TSA currently, while it currently checks only passengers' names, TSA plans to start cross-checking birth dates and genders as well.
Ooh.
Really, TSA? Really?
Wow. So wait, TSA finally got Microsoft Office?
Yeah, man.
They can run a Access database?
Student edition.
Student, well, yeah, of course. A little cheaper.
I mean, how about you just use some common sense? I mean, and for Mikey's troubles, perhaps some complimentary peanuts and a visit from the pilot might patch things up. Really? You're going to let a suspected terrorist visit the pilot?
Yes, and give him peanuts?
And give him peanuts?
Suspected terrorist with peanuts. If there's somebody with... If the pilot has a peanut allergy, you're giving the suspected terrorist peanuts you've brought that plane down.
You just brought the plane down in one fell swoop.
Seriously.
So, seriously, TSA, you are today's spectacle of human failure.
Blam!
All right. That'll pretty much do it for today, folks. I think we've achieved our goal today on Boldly Going Nowhere, in that we boldly went nowhere.
Yeah, I'm still here.
I haven't left my chair. I want to thank Evan Rosenberg.
Oh, you are very welcome.
For joining us.
The pleasure was all mine.
I'm glad to hear it, because I didn't have any.
In fact, you might even say that I was pleased as plunch.
There you go. That's what I was waiting for. Any final words on any of all the, any of this, you know, on any of this nonsense?
Any of this nonsense? Any words on that in particular? No, I think we've said what needs to be said. I got a... You know, plug I'd like to drop, though, if you don't mind.
By all means, sir. Please use my forum as a space to...
Oh, absolutely.
I'm just for self-aggrandizement.
I'm just here for the free advertising.
You know what? It's theirs. It's there, and take all right. Take.
You know, of course, I recommend that everybody who has not yet listened to the remaining archives of Very Thin Ice, located at verythinice.podomatic.com.
Oh, well, absolutely, because, you know... I can get in a little bit self-promotion there, too. I'm in that show. But
right. That was, of course, the show that Justin and I did before Justin and his friend Colin began the show.
Yeah.
Also, I want to announce to people who are unaware that the show that I have done a pilot for previously, some of you may have heard, if you've been listening to Very Thin Ice previous to the show, My old show, The Juxtaposers, is coming back, you know, sometime before the end of this month. Keep an eye out. The website for that is juxtaposers.podomatic.com. That's juxtaposers.podomatic.com. The first episode, the pilot episode, is already up in that feed, and there will be more coming soon.
Fantastic. I admire your vocabulary, by the way.
Yes, I made that word up myself.
All right, well, Evan, it was great having you.
Great to be here.
Folks, until next time, I'm Justin Eisenstadt, and we are boldly going nowhere.